Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/InForum, and you can follow the best of our speaker dialogue on Twitter with the hashtag InForumSF. I'm George Anders, contributing writer at Forbes and author of The Rare Find. Tonight, we're joined by Randall Strauss and Lisa Steindler. Randall Strauss writes the New York Times column, Digital Domain. He also is a professor of business at San Jose State University, and he has written several books about Silicon Valley, including The Launchpad, which officially will be published tomorrow. The book provides an inside look at Y Combinator, the famous finishing school for startups. Lisa Steindler is the executive artistic director of San Francisco's own Z-Space, one of the nation's leading laboratories for the development of new voices, new works, and new opportunities in American theater. She's famous for taking chances that work out. As the San Francisco Appeal put it, she has helped nurture a litter of prominent new playwrights in the Bay Area. They're here to talk to us about the new creative ethos forming at the intersection of art and Silicon Valley startup culture. So, let's get started. I'd like to ask both of you, and we'll start with Randall, what the two or three things are that you think are most important in finding genius. You've studied Y Combinator up close. What's the very tight checklist of what it takes to pick a winner?
The first thing that Y Combinator is not looking for is the sole genius. They want to fund teams of two or three, precisely because true genius comes along pretty rarely, but you can find a team of two really, really good people, or three. Four, it turns out, starts to edge into that number that is hard to manage. So their quest is not to find genius in its single form, but the equivalent as a team, which was a surprise to me. Mm-hmm. They also understand that one's abilities are not necessarily easily read by whatever one's current project is. So applicants to Y Combinator apply with an idea for a startup. In some cases, the startup is already started. In most cases, it's just an idea. And what they're going to do is fund not the idea, but the quality of the applicant. Because they understand that ideas come and go, but the underlying talent will persist. And that's what they're making their bet on.
Great. Lisa, in your world, I think you've also said picking the person is at least as important as the idea. Fill me in a little more of what you're looking for.
It's very similar. Hmm. It's very similar, which is interesting to me. It's a lot of the work that I do in putting a play together is putting a team together. That's my job as a producer and artistic director. It's figuring out who's going to work well, inspiring one another, who's going to push the boundaries one another, putting those people in a room, whether it's designers, playwrights, actors, directors. It's the team effort, though, that brings out the genius, ultimately, I think. It's very similar. I am also very drawn to people taking risks at no cost and pushing those boundaries and thinking outside of the box and not settling for the usual course, let's say.
So this is very different than a Hollywood studio where it's, you know, Titanic meets Terminator and you go, oh, those are two successes, it'll work well. You're looking for something that hasn't been done.
Absolutely. I mean, part of the pursuit is how do you push the boundaries of telling a story? You know, really pursuing a different way each time of storytelling. You know, it's one of the oldest forms that we have in the world as far as communications go. And they're... You know, we know that there are different ways of doing that in the artistic front as far as dance or film or TV or theater or music. But how do you tell a story and how do you find the genius way of telling that story each time differently?
So if someone strikes your fancy, and we'll start with Lisa on this, how much time do you give them? How much money do you give them? Are they off to the races or are you keeping a pretty tight rein on them?
They're definitely off to the races. I tend to, I'll just talk about playwrights at this point, because I also work on devised theater, which is really starting with a team of people from the ground up, not knowing what the concept is necessarily, and creating a piece of work. But with playwrights, it can be anywhere from a year to 3 to 4 years before an audience actually sees the work on stage. And they're very, you know, playwrights have different ways of working. Sometimes they want to be in a room alone writing the script, and the script's done, they hand it to me. And then we argue about how it needs more work, and they think it doesn't. Other pieces, we literally will come up with a concept with a playwright. They'll start working a script out. We'll do a workshop that perhaps has actors in the workshop, a dramaturg, a director, and start working the piece on its feet. And that could be 3, 4, 5 workshops until I think it's ready to go into a 4-week rehearsal period and then in front of an audience. That's somewhat of the process. And it's for me, it's always creating a different path for that work. It's never the same one. There's no cookie cutter to how I produce new work. And as far as the money is concerned, that varies. There is funding out there that is specifically for commissioning a brand new piece, which means more money ostensibly for the author, the playwright. You know, we try hard to pay people a living wage when they're working on our work, and it's very difficult.
Randall, you're coming out of a world with Y Combinator that works on a pretty tight time frame, and give me a sense of, if I get accepted, what are the next couple months of my life going to be like?
Well, Y Combinator was the pioneer of the 3-month process, which many other incubators and accelerators have emulated. So you're funded, and you've got 3 months before demo day, where a room full of investors will take a look at a short presentation. And during those 3 months, you are encouraged to get something that will be in suitable shape to be offered to the general public, or maybe a select group of beta users. But you are encouraged to get something out there, get feedback. I don't know if this is the equivalent to the workshop. Does the workshop involve a small invited audience?
Yes, a lot of time it does. Yes,
okay, so that's
process.
The beta test,
yep, same
right?
Same thing, yep.
Take what you learn and iterate as many times as you can in a short amount of time.
Yes.
And don't wait for the perfect feature-filled product.
Yes.
Get your feedback.
Yep.
Because you're going to probably learn that what you thought customers wanted is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are some exceptions. There are a few companies that have taken on technically very challenging problems, particularly in the database field, that can't do it in 3 months, it turns out. They can't do it even in an entire year. But they're the exception. The standard model is work very quickly to get something out. And today's software tools allow you to do it on a shoestring. So money actually isn't a barrier.
Yeah.
Hackers who are living a subsistence sort of existence.
Yes, I've read about that recently. They're all renting a room together and bunks. And
yeah,
typically.
The concept of ramen profitable. Do you want to explain that?
Yes.
So the most public face of Y Combinator, one of its founding partners, his name is Paul Graham. By the way, he has an interesting background in the painting world. So we can talk about, he's written about the connection between programming and painting.
Mm.
He is an exponent of the notion that you should have a combined workspace, a living space workspace. He is the philosopher behind Y Combinator. He started this experiment giving the participants a tiny dollop of money because they were just graduated college students. So the idea was it's just enough to get them through summer. And then if the idea has merit, investors would back the company. And if it didn't, it was over. It was really do or die.
Yeah.
What's happened, though, because of the success of the program, beginning a year and a half ago, they were able to get outside investors to commit to a $150,000 investment to every single company that's funded, every single startup, right from day one. So they know they have $150,000 in addition to the $14,000, $17,000, or $20,000 that Y Combinator invests in. And so what has happened now is demo day is important, but if you're not ready or if your idea isn't all that great and you're still struggling, you still have money left over to keep on trying. How do you cope?
Can I just say one thing, actually, going back to how long does it take for a play actually to get up on its feet? Probably if you condense the time into real time, it would be around 3 months as well. It just so happens that we can only work for a week here and there, or 2 weeks in a year, or something like that. So it might be a similar amount of time in actuality.
So in your world, do people need to sort of gulp and refresh and kind of step away from
go
the
Go away,
project
write
a bit?
Another play, to produce something, go to a retreat. Many a times, artists are working on multiple projects, mm-hmm. you know, literally 5 to 10 projects. So they come back and you gather the team together and it's probably a 2 to 3 month process at the end of it, I would say.
Okay, and in Randall's world, you get up in your combination bedroom and office and, you know,
go
get
for
your
it,
slippers
yeah.
on and start coding yeah. and go until you sleep.
Yeah.
Well, do playwrights want to work in their own space too? They don't rent an office, do they?
No, but most, you know, if you go to the shops, I have several playwrights that work right across the street from us at Coffee Bar. And they're in there every day because they want to be around people. Mm. They want to be in the public. They want to see what's happening on the streets. And much of the times you go back and read the plays that they've written in those places, you will see much of the street scene of what you're seeing there inside the play, which is always fun. You could be in a play and you don't know it.
So order carefully at the coffee bar. Randall, when we were coming up here, you were talking about how urbanized hacking has become. And I'd like both of you to talk about, are there advantages of being in the center of a bustling city like San Francisco mm-hmm. as opposed to being in Mountain View or being up in the Sierras?
Well, Paul Graham is often asked, could Silicon Valley be reproduced elsewhere? Why aren't there many Silicon Valleys? Why is there only just mm-hmm. one? And he has said, you need a great university with a world-class engineering program. You also need investors. They're kind of the two ingredients, and we have that in the Bay Area. But he's also added another layer to this, which is hackers like places with diverse populations that are welcoming of diversity. Mm-hmm. And even though Y Combinator is situated in Mountain View, and he's talked about the sterility of suburbia, one of the attractions of Y Combinator is coming here, and you are required to come here if you're not already based here, is San Francisco, and particularly San Francisco. So many of the Y Combinator startups, they're based here in the city. And they make the schlep down to Mountain View, even though Graham would like them during Y Combinator to move down to Mountain View or nearby. Increasingly, an ever higher percentage of each batch are making the decision to live up here, work up here, and as more of them do, the more attractive it becomes. So the Bay Area really has it all.
So, Lisa, you've seen playwrights write in all sorts of settings. So you've given us already the coffee bar down there on 18th.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other places that playwrights can write effectively?
Really, truly anywhere now, you know, with the technology. Most playwrights tend not to enjoy working alone in their apartments. Most, some do. I think you touch upon something as far as the vibrancy of this city and the diversity of this city. You know, several playwrights that I've worked with have a view of the world through a lens of the Bay Area, and that is extremely unique. because of Silicon Valley and the startups that are here, there's a sense of risk in this city, I think. And that finds its way onto the page into a lot of the work that we do. That's exciting to me. I'm interested in putting work on the stage that is a reflection of the world that we live in. And this is a very exciting world that we live in right now. And the Bay Area kind of is the epitome. I mean, we're sitting on the edge of this country. We could fall off into the ocean at any second. So we are a bunch of risk takers that just by the sheer fact that we're sitting here and living and choosing this city to live in.
It's a very interesting thought that danger helps people do better work. Yeah.
It can sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Both of you had made reference in passing to the idea that talented, prickly people have a hard time taking advice.
Hmm.
And I'd like each of you to riff on that a bit. How much input is welcomed and accepted, how much is fought and taken begrudgingly, and where does that help an idea get better? Should you listen to your critics?
You go first.
I'm very interested in hearing what happens with playwrights. With the hackers at Y Combinator, I talk about a grad school model. They are not closely supervised. Y Combinator does not provide workspace by design. And once they receive their funding, they are not obligated to have any contact with the partners if they don't want to. The Y Combinator formally is just an investor. And Graham says, I have no leverage. They have weekly dinners to bring everyone together, but on Tuesday nights, but the rest of the week, you spend your time on your own. And there is this expectation that you're the sort of person who is not going to screw up if left to your own devices, and that you do create when you have you create more freely if you don't have someone breathing down your neck. So Y Combinator's pitch is, we're here if you want us, and you set up office hours. Again, an academic institution. You make an appointment with an online system, and then you can come in and talk to the partners. And most of the companies do come in at least once a week, but they don't have to, because there's this recognition that the creative process requires space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, when I work on a show or with a playwright or a team of people, it's truly a marriage in some ways, and so I want my partner in that marriage to be somebody that I want to be with. Mm. That doesn't mean we can't fight and argue and push each other, but if you're really not a team player, I'm probably not the right producer for you, or Z-Space is potentially not the right place for you. Because it's not about solo. It is about collaboration and team building. And so I don't necessarily know that I surround myself or work with people that are so prickly that it just isn't going to work. I like a good fight. You know, stand up for what you believe in. Let's argue about it. Let's let the audience decide if it's going to work or not. Ultimately, they will decide. And I love being proven wrong.
Is there a time cycle that when you first suggest it, you're going to get a lot of pushback, and then half an hour later, a day later?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
And do you get to the point where both of you know it, or you have to discover it afresh each time?
It's probably discovering afresh each time, I would say. And it's always arguing with, you know, with respect, but, you know, you can't just say, I've been in this situation too, like, that's how it's written and that's how it's going to stay. It's like, well, okay, well, let's talk about why it's written that way. Let's talk about why you're saying that three times in a row. What is the impact you're trying to get to, and can we get to that on the second time you say it? Maybe we need to discover something in the process with the actors. Maybe there needs to be a pause. You know, so there's lots of different ways to have those conversations, which I love. You know, but if somebody's going to stonewall you, there is a point where you say, okay, let's try it. Let's try it in the rehearsal room. Let's try it with an audience. And then let's talk again. Let's revisit this. And usually you can do that. And it comes out with, I told you so, on one side or the other.
Randy, you got to see Y Combinator up close for months and months. What was the fiercest argument you saw in-house, and who won?
There was this one time when a company, early in the session, was weighing five different ideas. I believe three involved ideas that entailed selling to consumers, which is the hardest kind of thing to get started, and two were developer products that would be sold to fellow software developers. And the two founders really wanted to do a consumer idea. I think one of them was ready-made meals that you would, ready-made ingredients for ready-to-cook meals. And they were very excited about that. There was another idea to do a really, really good directory of hyper-local events, like happy hours at the neighborhood bar. And that hasn't been done well yet. And the YC partners, all of them, were trying to discourage them from these consumer ideas. And they weren't listening. And they'd get advice from one partner who would say, you should do this. They didn't like that advice. So then they go to another partner, go to another office hour until shop around. It's
right.
Like kids going to parents.
Mom
you know,
dad.
Wait until you get
yeah.
until you get the answer you want. You're just going to keep working through the roster. And I remember this one scene where they're told, the partners thought they had finally put to rest the whole idea of going consumer, and there it's back again. So this one partner said, just wait a second. Leaves, comes back with Paul Graham, and he said, essentially, you tell him what you just told me, and so they make the pitch again for a consumer idea, and Graham says something like, you can just drive off a cliff as far as I'm concerned, and walked out of the room. So
did they do it?
They abandoned it.
Okay.
They abandoned that. They went back to an idea that's, not very sexy, which involves detecting fraud by very sophisticated algorithms in websites like Airbnb to try to detect things like money laundering. And it has turned out to be quite successful. Graham couldn't order them to abandon it. But that shook them up.
So Lisa, I like the point you made earlier about, eventually you take it in front of the audience, or in Randy's case, the market, and then you discover which is right, and one side gets to say, I told you so. Do you usually know how an audience is going to react, or do you have some times where you go, I never would have thought that was going to happen?
Oh, there are definitely times where I never, ever thought that was going to happen. And
tell
a lot of the
story.
Time it's with comedy. I mean, comedy is so wonderful to unstage because you have just no idea where the laugh is going to come or if it's going to come. And that's the beauty of theater. I used to be an actor as well. It's too hard, though. I can't do that anymore. It's really hard. But it's a matter of a beat in the right place or a breath in the right place and how you can feel that synergy of the actors and the audience coming together to find those moments, to mine those moments. One of the best comedy things I saw on stage was not supposed to be there, which is the beauty of magic, or the magic and beauty of theater is, anything can happen at any time because it's live.
Was it inadvertent, or was it?
Yes. It was a technical mistake that happened, actually. And I was on stage at the Geary Theater, not at the Geary, actually, at the Marines Memorial Theater, and I happened to be a secretary in the scene, so I wasn't actually in the scene. There were two actors on the front having an argument with one another. And inadvertently, the phone went off, and the phone cue was not supposed to go off in that scene. And it kept going, and they both kind of looked at it to the point where somebody had to answer it. So one of the actresses picked up the phone. She waited a moment, and she turned to the other actress, and she said, "It's for you," and walked off the stage. So I think, I think they're, to me, a lot of the beauty in theater is that it's the magic when Things aren't supposed to happen necessarily.
Randall, you've got a magic when things get shown to the marketplace. And tell us some stories of things that Airbnb or Dropbox might be good ones, big successes. What are some of the surprises that happen when companies first launch?
Well, what can happen, of course, is nothing happens. Mm. Many of the Y Combinator companies rely on announcements in TechCrunch to get word out and hopefully be spread virally. The story of Codecademy's launch. Codecademy was part of the summer batch I followed. It's a website that offers to teach anyone how to program, self-directed online courses. And they launched. They didn't think they were going to launch. They thought they were going to have a little beta test. But mention was made on Hacker News, the website, the Y Combinator, the news aggregation site, the Y Combinator runs. Word spread very quickly. And the two guys were at a burrito place. They'd stepped out of their apartment. They had an app on their phone that showed the traffic on their website, and the arrow had an arrow and just went all the way over to the right and then to stop there, where clearly it could go no farther. Mm. And they realized, oh, we better take the food. They swept up the food and headed back to the apartment as quickly as possible because their website was essentially being overwhelmed. Mm. They had like 200,000 users in, I think, a week.
Wow.
So they did not anticipate that it was going to take off, and it turned out to be easily the most successful product launch of the whole batch.
Great.
I had a question for Lisa.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just thinking about the portfolio effect that's very important for Y Combinator as an investor. They don't have to sweat every single funding decision mm-hmm. because at this point they're funding 64 companies at a time. I wondered if you have ever thought about a season, a year, as a kind of portfolio, and do you try to strike a balance of certain kinds of works, more experimental here, less experimental to get a balance? So do you put all your chips on very high-risk projects?
No, it's a really good question. Part of what we do at zSpace is we also curate work in the space. So we have about 42 weeks out of the year of programming for the public. And so those are not enormous risks for us, obviously. But we look around and say, what does the public want? Maybe this section of the year is going to be modern dance. We're going to look around in the Bay Area and say, this would work well in here. We put in film. For us, though, as far as our producing our own work, you have to spread it out. You have to spread it out. And I also have this kind of mantra where I make sure there's 80% of the funding in place before I do a show, because if it's a bomb, I don't want to put the organization at risk. And that's hard, because people are investing in something they have no idea what it is. I have no idea what it is half the time, except I believe in the people and the concept and the project. But I don't know. I don't know that it's going to be Oklahoma at the end of the night or Greece. It's an unknown piece that I am asking people to have faith in. But I might not have the audience, and it could be not a critical acclaimed piece. The critics might not like it, and the audience might not come. And I've got 10 people in a 250-seat theater. That doesn't feel good. Doesn't mean it's not worthy work, but you have to spread the risk around. Absolutely, yeah.
How often can you come back and say, you know what, the market was wrong, the audience was wrong, this is a great piece and it deserves a second chance?
There are a few pieces. A recent piece that I did called The Companion Piece, which was a devised work by some local people, Mark Jackson, Jake Rodriguez, Beth Wilmert, Chris Kuchenbaker, incredible team of people we brought together and came up with a concept. The basic concept was to think of vaudeville, and two of the characters were trying to come up with a headliner act. What does that look like in an evening of theater? One of the things we realized is that because we didn't know what it was seriously until previews, we really didn't know what it was. So we didn't know how to market it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you start marketing 2-3 months out. And we realized that we had marketed the piece absolutely wrong. And during our previews, we brought in schools, we brought in students from high school and from colleges, and they loved it. Loved it, loved it, loved it. And we were pitching the piece as this vaudevillian, strange, musical, theatrical, wonky thing. That wasn't a very good pitch for that. But we realized the audience was the wrong audience we were seeking. And in a way, it was too late because we were already in it so deep and all of the marketing had gone out. And all of a sudden, you know, after the reviews came out, we started going back to the people we wanted. We were doing $10 tickets, you know, ticket and a beer and popcorn, trying to get quickly back to that audience. But, you know, it's that's a piece that I wish a lot more people had seen. And it's not a piece that will ever be seen again. Mm-hmm. There's no script for it, really. It was once in a lifetime piece, and it's gone. Mm-hmm. So you missed it.
Randall, are there resurrections in your world? Or, you know, once you've had your launch, that's all you're going to get?
One of the questions is, how long should you persist? Is the idea fundamentally flawed, or have you just not executed well enough? And Paul Graham tells the founders they should persevere, but not necessarily with the same idea. That you do try it, you give it your best shot. If you don't see signs of acceptance, and there's a very high threshold. He's looking for 10% growth of, be it revenue or users, if it's not yet revenue, 10% a week. And
wow.
If that is not happening, then you need to rethink your idea.
Mm-hmm.
So he tells people, don't give up, but what he's referring to is don't give up the idea of coming up with something.
Yeah, yeah.
But accept the fact.
But ideas are disposable.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But they have a much shorter lifespan than a performance. Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I've been pitched an idea and I'm like, that sounds great. I've never heard of that. And then I get the script and it's awful. Like, keep the idea and get rid of the script. But take the risk.
I have another idea. A question for Lisa.
Of course.
That's not fair.
I'm curious whether the age of playwrights matters. Because one of the experiments that Y Combinator undertook was how low could you push the minimum threshold to have successful founders. So when Graham and his partners funded these just graduated, freshly graduated college students. And the reason it was 3 months was because that was the summer.
Right.
And they figured if it didn't work out, they'd
go
off to graduate school, which actually happened in one case. So that's why it was packed into 3 months. But they have funded people who not only have not finished college, one of the founders in my batch hadn't finished high school.
Wow. Aren't there child labor laws?
Yeah, I was going to say.
So I'm curious. What is the average age? Is there a cluster? Is there an ideal time when you've had enough life experience, you have something to say? It can't be pushed too young?
The average, it's interesting because I have several playwrights I'm working with that are right out of graduate school, so they're quite young, because I am interested in that voice, and which is a very different voice from a 40 or 50-year-old playwright. Just as a New York playwright has a different voice than a San Francisco one, I think. I think it is important to have that life view sometimes. But I would say the average age of playwrights that I work with is probably around mid-40s. But there are several that I'm working with now in their 20s. Mm. And what I'm always interested too is, it goes with that for actors too, how I love getting the students who have just graduated from ACT or some other conservatory in their early 20s and pairing them up with a veteran actor in their 60s. I love working with people who are just making that leap into professionalism and kind of finding organic mentors for them within the process. That's exciting to me. And it's exciting for the people in their elders in the group. It's really exciting to have that kind of youthful approach to it. But you know what? They're geniuses, you know this, who are 18 years old. Am I interested in working with them? Yes.
So there's one last question I wanted to bring out before we open it up to the audience. Randall, your world is almost entirely male. I mean, startups, particularly when you form teams, it just tends to be two people with Y chromosomes. Lisa, your world is much more balanced. Talk a little bit about...
Not much more.
Okay. Perspectives from both of you. Is there a gender tilt, and what can be done to overcome it?
There was, this is again with playwrights, back, I believe it's in 2009, there was a study done. At the time, there were 12% female playwrights being done in the regional circuit, the larger theaters. 12%.
Wow.
That's 88%. Of males were writing the playwrights, were writing the plays. So this person who conducted this study decided she was going to send out identical scripts, half with female names on it and half with male names on it, out to the regional theaters. Artistic directors, literary managers all read them. Do you know what happened?
I'm frightened to ask.
Can you guess what happened?
Oh, my.
It's what you're thinking.
Yeah.
The majority, the vast majority came back of the male playwrights saying that they were interested in these plays. And and I think it was about 15% of the female ones, same scripts.
Wow. So you've got a controlled experiment, same caliber of work, and if it's a guy, he'll get a commission, and if it's a woman,
and a lot of them are female ADs.
I was going to ask about the reviewers.
A lot are females. Yeah. Unfortunately, this study was a really good study that happened, actually, because it really made people aware of how awful the situation is across the field. In a national conversation, people really started looking at their season, saying, "Wait a second, we don't have a female playwright in our six play season. Can't do that." So it was a great study in that sense to really make people aware of it, because I don't think they were. Yeah.
So what's the makeup of conservatory student bodies?
It's more women are applying for them, but now they're really trying to make them even, male female. But they have many more women applying, many more.
But in Y Combinator's case, yes, overwhelmingly male, and what the partners say is it reflects the skewed division in the applicant pool.
Yep.
And so our class is going to reflect, our selections will reflect whatever it is in the applicant pool.
Yep.
And that won't change until girls in middle school take up programming.
I meet my share of female programmers, and I think there may be a sense of you can work for the team, but you can't lead the team. And is there a role for the Y Combinators of the world to change that?
Well, these are so small teams. So if you're a two- or three-person team, and there's no leader.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that will lead. If you walk into the interview room and there's clearly one dominant personality, that team will not get funded. I watched that happen during the finalist
that's
interview.
That's interesting. That's really interesting.
They want a team of equals.
Mm. That's really
and the very worst combination is a team where there are, say, two technical people, one non-technical person, and the non-technical person is bossing the other two around.
Right.
That's called hackers in a cage.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh. That's interesting.
You know, as long as we've moved a little bit toward funding, Robert Deckers is with us today. He is artistic director for Post Ballet, and he's got some interesting stories to tell about how he got funded through Kickstarter.
Yeah, my company, Post Ballet, just finished our third season here in San Francisco. And we actually used Kickstarter twice, first for our first season and then again with a larger ask for our second season. What was interesting is that we were really able to, by pinpointing a specific project that we were asking for, really engage different people, not just from the Bay Area, but from throughout the states and abroad even, and getting donations that were usually under the $100 range, lots of small donations, some people who knew either myself or dancers, others who just liked our video and wanted a free t-shirt. But our first year we had a goal of $3,000, which we met, and so we did the Kickstarter project again our second year with an $8,000 goal. And what's interesting about Kickstarter is that it has a make or break motto. So if we only get to $7,000, goal is $8,000, and the 30 days is run up, you don't get any of the funds pledged. Other sites like Indiegogo offer you a chance to take that portion of your goal back home. But we went with Kickstarter because what I found was really interesting, and through match programs that we... Our first year, we got a San Francisco Foundation matching commission grant. And when you have that goal of all or nothing, what we found consistently is that lots of last-minute donations come in from people who have, in some cases, doubled what they gave in past giving asks. The downside of something like Kickstarter is that it doesn't necessarily build a patron base long-term in the Bay Area. People who saw our video and live in Michigan aren't necessarily going to become seasoned patrons. So as far as long-term funding, it's not necessarily the way to build your infrastructure. But we did have great success, and by having those campaigns early in our company's seasons, we were able to kind of create a voice and a presence here in the Bay Area that has since allowed us to kind of expand our reach into the individual donor pool and foundationally having a product to show through these first projects and now moving forward into an expanding season. So for us, it was a really great fit using technology, using that kind of social media. We did a lot of Facebook, Twitter posts. Really was great for our company to kind of move forward and present work that was kind of unknown to the Bay Area at the time.
Now, if I were trying to use Kickstarter, I'd probably tell people how desperate I was and how none of my other funding mechanisms had worked out, and this was the last chance before I went lights out, which might not be a really effective way to position. What did you do to give people a sense of optimism and energy? How did you couch the ask?
Well, I think what I found is that asks have to find a balance, at least in the nonprofit world. And I imagine it would probably be similar in the for-profit world as well. If you look like everything's going perfectly and swimmingly, why give money if everything's great? If you look like you're a sinking ship, well, I don't want to put my $10 into that one, thanks. So kind of being honest with the fact that, yes, we have funding, and yes, this and this have gone through, but without this additional funding, and that for the first 2 years did come from Kickstarter, we really weren't able to present, you know, our full season, or at least in the way that we were able to with those additional funds and fully execute the program in the way that I had envisioned it. So I do think it's, well, I think most importantly is being honest. I think that people know when you're trying to pull them one way or the other. But definitely I think that keeping that kind of strong presence of this is what we're doing and not looking too desperate, I would suggest maybe avoid that one when you're doing your Kickstarter project.
Terrific. We have an opportunity for questions now. I see a microphone here if people want to queue up, and we'll be able to use the last few minutes for Q&A.
Hi.
All yours.
Thank you. So I'm wondering with the Y Combinator, how do they encourage or kickstart the creativity for these teams? Now, I know the founders talked to them a little bit, but is there anything that in particular that they do to help them kind of get rolling in terms of idea creation and that type of thing?
They're happy to talk about possibilities, but they do rely on the founders bringing possibilities to them. They're not going to say, I think you should do this or that. Although Graham does have a list of very, very ambitious ideas that he invites anyone to tackle. But they're the ideas that are so enormous that they've scared founders away. One of the things that they can count on, the Y Combinator can count on, is that everyone who is applying and gets in loves what they do. And this is one of his points in his essay, Hackers and Painters. What a similarity. To do something well, you have to love it.
Absolutely.
And so that makes a big difference.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Great. Next question.
Yes, you talked about lower bounds on the age group of people. What about upper bounds? And especially now, you know, there's been a lot of layoffs and moving around of jobs, especially in the upper areas, of people that have lots of experience, lots of ideas, and need some help.
Well, the upper boundary there was one founder who was over 40. There were a handful that were in their 30s. So the median must have been something like 25.
So this is like gymnastics. I mean, if you're past 25, you're really near the end of your career.
Right. And the older founders, in almost all cases, were married, had children, and had to face this question, and were elsewhere in the country. Do you move everyone to Silicon Valley for the summer, which is a costly proposition, or not? And they came up with different answers. But one of the companies I profile, the two founders were from Alabama. And they brought their combined five children. And the two families, so four adults, five children, live in this tiny house, rental house in Mountain View for the summer. I naturally took a special interest in the older founders in the batch. Spent more of my time with them than proportionately would have been justified, because I found it a great human interest story. Mm-hmm. They weren't 22 or 23. They were a little bit older. They had the obligations of middle-aged people. And yet they managed to make it happen. Now, was everything great at home? I don't know. That could have been very difficult. But there were some outliers. By outliers, I mean in their 30s.
Yeah. And what about with playwrights?
Well, like I said, I mean, I think that I welcome people who are seasoned and have been in the business. I think that they bring a lot of many different aspects to the table that I'm interested in, and I think our audience is interested in. A question kind of goes to the dance community, too. There are many dancers, choreographers, who are now getting into their 50s, 60s, and 70s and 80s. What happens now? For me, their life work is there's so much still to do, and they have so much to offer to an audience or to a young company of choreographers and/or dancers. So for me, it's bring them in the room, let's start talking. Give them parts.
Let me just say, as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect, and tonight we're hosting Conjuring Up Genius, Silicon Valley Meets the Arts, with Randall Strauss, author of The Launchpad, Inside Y Combinator, Silicon Valley's Most Exclusive School for Startups, and Lisa Steindler, Executive Artistic Director of San Francisco's Z-Space. I'm George Anders, contributing writer at Forbes, and be happy to take a couple more questions if we have them. Yes, please.
So, Randall, I'm one of those non-technical co-founders that boss the other guys around. So I was really interested in what you had to say about also that part of it, like one clear leader. So most of the great companies, let's take Steve Jobs and Apple or Jeff Bezos, that one clear, really strong personality, basically, I mean, even in Apple, I mean, Jobs is a genius when it came even to tech, but he kind of had that vision, right? And it almost, I like this, I wanted to come to this because he always said it's where technology and humanities meet is where you create great companies and great products. So it's very interesting to me that, well, Y Combinator, we didn't do Y Combinator, but you know, a bunch of my guys have done it and been in the program, and a bunch of my friends. We went the different funding route. But I've always been interested that, you know, Y Combinator does, like, yeah, technical founders, hackers, everything like that. But then there's that piece of, you know, you guys are coming in and say they're really excited about this, like, one project of, like, we've all done it. Like, oh, we can do hyperlocal XYZ, right? So my company's local too, right, mobile. But I was always interested, like, when you see that one personality, you know, could you think to say, okay, maybe it's not technical, but he has something special. He has a vision that he can see that's out, you know, that's out there, right? So it's usually the crazy ones, like they say, the ones that can say, I'm trying to predict the future, and I'm building up toward that. So, what do you see when people come in like that?
I did see some teams in the finalist stage come in that fit that profile. Yeah. And I watched the partners discuss it, and they just couldn't become comfortable with that model. That's just not what they do. I'm sure you're familiar with 500 startups.
Oh, I know Dave, yeah, I know.
and they have a little different philosophy where design is their strength. And they're looking for teams with strong design backgrounds.
Yeah.
So Y Combinator isn't, I would say, isn't typical in any way. This just happens to be their preference. It's all technical. I know Paul Graham has said, we often think of, you know, Steve Jobs with Apple, Bill Gates with Microsoft, Larry Ellison with Oracle. And he says, but remember, in all three of those cases, it was a pair of co-founders.
True.
Yeah. At the very beginning.
Yeah, very, very true. And then last question for you, ma'am. So I'm a creative as well. So I used to do mobile games. I did a bunch of Facebook games. And it was always interesting to me, too, that even with writers and stuff, so since I'm, you know, the CEO, founder of a company, but also a creative as well, I've always struggled with the kind of destructive, you know, when you're creative, when you create, it comes from a different place than it is when you're coding or programming. And I always found myself going around and, you know, kind of being alone and trying to come up with something, but, you know, it's always from a place that's different than if I'm having to build like a coding product or, you know, something like that, more business related. So what do you think about that? When you meet writers, do they come to you and say, you know, they kind of give their all, right? They almost sacrifice their own soul to create some great piece of art. And I just always found, like, you know, how do they deal with it, or have you seen that a lot?
I have seen that a lot, but I am not of the school that you have to suffer for your art necessarily. And I, you know, there are a lot of people who feel that, and they have to, you know, suffer deeply for their art. I don't necessarily believe that, though. To me, it's finding somebody. You mentioned it, Randy mentioned it earlier, that somebody who has asked the question, especially in what I do. If there is anything else in your life that you have as equal interest, go do it. Because what we're doing is really freaking hard. You will never make a lot of money doing what we do. You'll never really be famous. But if you love it, if you love it deeply and there's nothing else you can do, there's a place for you. And there's a place that that can be nurturing and that can be wildly creative in that sense, that doesn't have to make you go to the dark, dark places, you know. And I, you know, to each his own. Some do, and that's what they need to do. And I understand that. You know, I get that.
San Francisco is famous for a lot of those types.
Yes.
Okay. Cool. Thanks, guys.
So, Lisa, I actually want to build on the last question. Do you ever see anything in the world of coders and computers in the Valley that has dramatic appeal, or is that just not the stuff that great plays are made out of?
No, it's totally amazing because, I mean, they're coming up with ideas that don't necessarily exist. And forgive me because I don't know your world that well. But the fact that you're putting a team together in a room with not necessarily a concept, I mean, I'm fascinated about human interaction in that room. I would love to see how the hierarchy starts working in that room. The characters that come out, the, who's leading, who's following. That to me, it's like, that's juicy. I would just love to have a little camera to watch all of that. That's juicy.
Let's seize the moment, Randall.
Well, I want to follow up. You say, what did you say? Let's use a camera?
Yeah, I want to see that.
Well, I have a little story to tell about cameras. So when I approached Paul Graham to do the book the spring before the summer, he initially said no. He said he liked my earlier book, E-Boys, knew my work. He said, I have no problem with you doing this, but I've already given permission to a team of filmmakers who are going to be here. And I think it would just be too much to have that team and you doing the book at the same time. So I thought, I'm out of luck. They got there first. And then 2 weeks later, he sent me an email saying, I've given it some thought. It's going to be a big batch. It's going to be 64 companies. There are plenty of companies to go around. So you both can do it.
Wow.
I was glad, but I was glad to have gotten the approval to move forward, but this was not ideal.
Yeah.
Because having a film crew,
it changes things.
It would change everything. It
changes things.
And this is, you know, these companies, they're nervous enough.
Yep. Being put under the microscope
and
like that.
So. One of the first dinner, the crew was there, and I was sitting in a conversation with several of the founders, and the crew just came up and said, "Do you mind?"
Yeah.
And here are two cameras.
Do you mind is not really a question.
It was not. It was a prelude to.
We're going to stick this in your face now.
And the three of us, we all froze. Then, you know, the director said, go on. And they tried to resurrect the thread of the conversation. Then they left and we all just relaxed. So as a writer, I have the advantage of not being so obtrusive.
Right.
I can't.
Right.
I don't know I can claim that it was as if I was truly a fly on the wall, and my presence made absolutely no difference at all. But I certainly wasn't a film crew.
Right.
So to finish the story, that first week turned out to be the only time they were there. They didn't get their funding. So it fell through, and I ended up being able to work unobtrusively alone without a film crew.
That's great. I think the other thing that we do are work. I'm very curious about some of the companies and the creations that are happening technologically out of Silicon Valley and with the startups. And I say that as far as, you know, some of the work that we do is a lot of it's film and video. And how do you? I'm not a huge proponent of using video in my work because it's live, and unless you really need it. It for me, sometimes it's a Band-Aid on top of the piece. That doesn't mean I don't love it, but it's how you incorporate it with live theater or dance. I think it has to be very thoughtfully done. But there's some amazing technology happening as far as real-time finessing of video. You know, the whole, I think it's called RainWorks, where you can actually have words dropping down in the, I don't know how it works, so... But words coming down through video that you can manipulate by the movement of your arm somehow. Or you can have video on screen and you can just in real time swipe it with your hand. So, and these, it's not necessarily programmed through Isadora, but it's happening, again, in real time. That's of interest to me, of integrating that technology in the work that we do. So
many opportunities. And in fact, I want to grab onto one of Lisa's points that you start with your teams at Y Combinator. They're best of friends. Otherwise, they wouldn't be working together. How many of those friendships rupture, and what causes them to come undone? And how many of them just barely survive through a lot of stress?
Looking at that batch, so it's been a year and a half almost since they finished their term. There have been a few divorces. But I think the worst divorce, the high-conflict divorce that comes immediately to mind, involved two founders who had come together just before they applied. So it was a non-technical co-founder who had lost his technical co-founder and needed a replacement. And a friend had recommended this other friend, and they'd come together. And it turned out they didn't know one each other well enough to withstand the stresses that they were then subjected to. And that's why Paul Graham says to just graduated students, you should get started now, because the most important thing you need is co-founders you're close friends with, that you've worked with together, and that's who you already have that. They're in the form of your college friends.
Yeah.
And you need to get going now, because if you go back to them in a few years, it's likely they're going to be engaged in some other project and won't be available to work with you.
That's
so
similar,
22 is kind of an ideal time to get started.
It's actually similar in the theater world, too, as far as playwrights and directors. That very tight relationship where a playwright can write something and a director has the ability to pull it on its feet and put it into reality in the theater. And those partnerships where you have a playwright and a director from the very beginning, and much of it comes out of school, that can stay together throughout the process, can stay together through 10, 15, 20 years. Ultimately, the end result of that relationship, where there's a shared language, unspoken sometimes, that shared language, I think the result can be some of the most magnificent work when you have that paired relationship.
That's fascinating. And then they even know how to argue nice, which can be crucial, too.
They know how to argue silently, which is amazing sometimes.
Eyebrows, tongues.
The movement.
Yeah. So we're down to our final minute or two, and this is a Commonwealth Club tradition. We now end all our events by asking our speakers the following question. Randall and Lisa, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world? I know you're each wanting to go first.
It's like the phone.
Yeah.
Randall, you've already got a book. You can summarize from your book. What would you do to change the world?
Small is beautiful. And isn't that what a startup is? That you have a range of motion when you're very small that you don't have when you're big. And I think that's the intrinsic power of the idea of startups. Start fresh, start clean with a fresh, clean sheet of paper, and unencumbered by bureaucracy, tradition, custom ways of doing things, you get to start afresh. And what has more inspiring power than a beginning? Startups are all about beginnings.
Terrific. Thank you. Lisa?
What he said. It really is the same thing. I think the other thing is my dream would be for people to see more value in the artist. It's not a hobby. It's a craft that is needed in this world. It creates empathy. It creates communities. And I would like to see, especially in our country, artists treated with more dignity and and better living wages. You know, it's hard. It's a hard craft to be married to.
Those are two great calls for action. Thanks very much, everyone, for attending. Thank you, Randall and Lisa, for leading the
discussion.
Thank you. Our meeting is adjourned.